BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Things Fell Apart. Strange Tales from the Culture Wars. I'm John Ronson, a writer living in America, the land where culture wars begin. And by culture wars, I mean the battle for dominance between conflicting values. These wars can obsess us, consume our lives. I was curious to learn how things fell apart, and so I went back in history to find the origin stories, the pebbles thrown in the pond, creating the ripples. This is the story of what might be the online world's first ever culture war, a war fought right at the birth of the internet. And the stakes couldn't have been higher. It was a war over who the internet belonged to, who would make the rules.
I do remember my stomach dropping, and I remember thinking that something quite awful had happened.
In the 1980s, before the invention of the World Wide Web, there was a nascent thing called Usenet. It was a collection of message boards for the tiny number of people from academic and tech institutions who knew of its existence. Like Brad Templeton, who until then had used computers just to play games and make spreadsheets.
This was an epiphany for me. It was the realization that the use of the computer to talk to other people, this was where the real gold was. This was the most important thing that computers would do.
Usenet's newsgroups were like subreddits today, pages dedicated to conversations about atheism or sex or winemaking or tech.
It was the central square, the main social venue. Every night your computer would call other computers and exchange everything that was new with them, and you could then have a discussion with people around the world. Typically, this would be done by the computer at a lab, a computer company, or a university, but a random individual at home with a personal computer could not at first easily join this.
Brad was in his 20s then and running a software company, Looking Glass Software, in Ontario, Canada. But he could access Usenet via his old alma mater, the nearby University of Waterloo.
As a consequence, the audience was pretty highly educated, usually well off, probably not that ethnically diverse either. There were bars in terms of technological knowledge as well. So you had a, you know, you might call a more elite crowd, a more erudite crowd.
Did you feel like you were like architects of a city that other people would start to move into?
Yes, we definitely felt we were at the beginning of something. Now, we didn't know that it would be Facebook or it would be Twitter or so on, or we'd all be billionaires. Well, a few of us are, but not me.
To give you a sense of how pioneering this little group was, one day in 1982, Brad posted a message suggesting emails might be easier to read if they put a dot in there. Others agreed, and that's why our email addresses now end in .com and not .com. But Brad wanted his Usenet legacy to be more fun than that. His parents had been entertainers, his father a televangelist, his mother a singer on TV variety shows. Show business ran through his veins. So you set up your own message board.
Yes, I decided I would like to make a special moderated and, in fact, edited news group, which was devoted to comedy.
What was it called?
It was called rec.humor.funny.
Brad's comedy page grew popular very quickly. By 1988, it was Usenet's seventh most popular page with 24,000 subscribers. They would send him jokes and he'd post one a day, the ones he found funniest.
Now, as it happens, I had automated as much as I could of my job so that I wouldn't have to sit there manually posting each joke in the morning. So what I had done was had automated programs that every morning would go through the collection of approved jokes that I had made and pick one at random and send it out.
What Brad didn't know was that one of those jokes was about to make him a different kind of pioneer. The first person in recorded history to be publicly shamed because of something they did online.
So it happened that a joke made fun of both Jewish and Scottish stereotypes. I myself am part Jewish and part Irish.
Well, I'm Jewish and my wife is Scottish. So when you tell me the joke, I'll be able to tell you whether or not it's...
Oh, I have to tell the joke. I suppose I do have to tell the joke.
Of course.
Anyway, the problem was that the randomness of the computer chose to release this joke on one of the anniversaries of Kristallnacht.
Kristallnacht was the night that the Nazis ran rampage and broke the windows of Jewish businesses all over Germany. It means the night of broken glass.
The computer, of course, completely unaware of that, decided to post a joke. And the joke goes, a Scotsman and a Jew are having supper together. And to a bit of surprise, when the bill comes, the Scotsman is heard to say, I'll pay it. And he does. And in the newspapers the next day, there's a story in the corner saying, a Jewish ventriloquist found strangled in Blind Alley.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know...
I can hear the laughter coming. I didn't rate this as a particularly funny joke, but it's got all the classic elements.
Yeah, it has the combination of words that approximate a joke. I should say, as a Jew married to a Scot, I did not feel necessarily any sort of flinch of rage when he told me that joke. But at the same time, I certainly can't speak for all Jews.
The point is that when this joke went out, it did enrage a Jewish fellow at MIT in the United States. He was Jewish and he was very bothered by the joke, and he decided to engage in a very specific campaign to basically get the news group shut down, what today would be called canceling.
The Jewish man was a Brit called Jonathan Richmond, who sadly died last year. He shared a flat at MIT in Boston with another Brit who remembers the incident well. He doesn't want to be named, so I'll call him Amir.
He and I shared the fact that we were both sensitive to racism, anti-Semitism. So it wasn't unusual for, in particular, Jonathan to come bursting in to say, oh, what about this? What about that? But this particular one, he clearly, you know, was personally affected by. And, you know, to be fair, you know, so was I. There was something really important about the date as well. You know, this was, I think, coming out on the anniversary of Kristallnacht.
And so Jonathan and Amir were about to become pioneers too. Nobody had ever tried to clean up the online world before. First, Jonathan went after Brad's livelihood, posting on Usenet, quote, I am having some friends investigate Looking Glass software, their operations and their clients. I am in the mood to take some affirmative action on this individual.
He said he wanted to call my employer and get me fired, but I was running my own software company, so I was unlikely to fire this terrible person.
Next, Jonathan appealed to the Usenet community, writing that he usually enjoyed jokes made at his own expense, but he couldn't tolerate humour associated with the persecution and murder of races. But Usenet people responded by calling him a dweeb who should learn to laugh at himself, and almost no one took his side. If you're thinking the same thing, that he and his flatmate Amir were overreacting to a basically mere joke, here from Amir is some context.
Look, my parents came from East Africa in the 1960s, and when looking for a place to rent, first coming to the UK, there were signs that basically said, you know, no Asians or coloureds. I'd certainly been attacked a few times by skinheads.
And it wasn't only the street violence. Amir and I are the same age, and I can tell you that growing up watching TV in Britain in the 1970s could be dispiriting.
What colour is sin?
I've got a feeling it's going to be black.
Of course it is. And his soul was black with sin. You're even black on the outside. God knows what you're like on the inside.
Nice to be with you. This fellow walked in a sex shop. He said, have you getting those blow-up dolls? He said, we only got black ones left. He said, well, I'm not racial prejudiced. Give us one of those. Got it home, blew it up, and it mugged him.
You're unemployed?
Yes, please.
Only one day a week I'm working.
What do you do then?
I'm going to the unemployment exchange for to be collecting my money. I get more money for not being working than when I'm working.
My parents actually emigrated from the UK in the early to mid 80s, partly because they were fed up with racist abuse.
They moved to Canada, and by coincidence, before he transferred to MIT, Amir had studied at Brad's old university, Waterloo, whose computers Brad was now using to publish his jokes.
Just to give you some sense, you know, Waterloo, that's where the BlackBerry was invented. It was responsible for sending more graduates to Microsoft, which, you know, was the biggest name at the time, than any other university on the planet.
Amir and Jonathan saw in Brad an omen. He was setting a tone online that successive generations might be stuck with.
I knew that my university had an outsized role in the whole IT space. And so realizing that if something like that was left unchecked, it would also have an outsized negative impact. And I just thought, this is something that needs to be nipped in the bud.
But all their attempts had so far failed. What recourse did they have left? And then they hit on it.
We hatched a plan because I was actually going to be going back to the University of Waterloo to visit my then girlfriend. And the idea was to speak to the local newspaper. I think it was the Kitchener-Waterloo Record. We wanted to achieve a public shaming through bad press.
I'm Louisa D'Amato, and I'm a reporter at the Waterloo Region Record.
Louisa remembers this story like it was yesterday.
I thought this was a very important story that was in front of me that these two men had brought to us. And I read these jokes, and I do remember my stomach dropping. And I remember thinking, oh my God, there's no one in charge. In traditional media, the mainstream media, if you don't like what they say, you can go to some larger body that regulates the media. And this didn't feel like that. This felt like the Wild West.
In the piece that you wrote, the way you described the Jewish joke, you wrote, another joke describes a Jew who is murdered after he tricks a Scotsman into buying him dinner. I did think that was a funny way to describe it.
The way I described that joke was to strip it of its humour, because in the joke, the Jew is a ventriloquist, and there's sort of a carefree, playful tone to the joke. But when you actually look at the bare bones of what that joke is saying, you see it differently.
And so Louisa published under the headline, University of Waterloo Computer System Used to Send Racial Jokes, much to Brad's bewilderment.
There was a story on the front page of the newspaper or the front page of Section 2 for a full week. Most people agreed that the reporter had something going because this was not the sort of story which merited that level of coverage to most people's minds.
But Louisa says all she had going was this.
This is the 1980s. I'm a young woman, Italian and Jewish. And like many women in the 1980s, I was in a struggle to be taken seriously.
She trawled through Brad's message board and found more jokes that made her heart sink.
There was a joke about an African-American man who was dating a gorilla and wanted to go into a bar and was not able to have the gorilla accompany him. So he shaved it, put a dress on it, and then everybody thought that he was dating an Italian woman. Although I was approaching this as a reporter with the proper attention to all sides of the story, it made me feel marginalized and I felt denigrated.
That was embarrassing for the university. They didn't like being on the front page of the newspaper, declared as participating in horrible racism and anti-Semitism.
Still, Brad was inundated with messages of support from Usenet users, plus one letter of support from a member of the public who turned out to be a Nazi living in Canada. Not a neo-Nazi, but someone who had actually fought for Hitler in the war. He told Brad that it was great that people were telling Jewish jokes on the computer.
I'm actually very thick-skinned and don't get upset or angry or anxious, but this crossed many of my lines. I was racked. I was not sleeping well. You don't like showing up on the front page of your local newspaper being called an anti-Semite.
The story ran, and the university pretty much immediately announced that it would not tolerate being a hub for this sort of racially offensive material, and they suspended Brad Templeton's account.
But Jonathan and Amir's victory was short-lived, as the Usenet community, watching on with sardonic amusement, could have told them.
This was the first time I had seen anyone in a position of authority trying to ban anything on Usenet. And I remember vividly thinking at the time, what a fool, he thinks he can ban this, it's not going to work.
This is Usenet pioneer and computer scientist Brian Reed, who was then an assistant professor of electrical engineering at Stanford University in the heart of the emerging Silicon Valley.
Every internet technologist understood that the internet was uncensorable. This was designed so that no one could be blamed for it. Your boss couldn't call you in and say, you're doing this, because the answer is everyone is doing this, and if I stop, nothing will change because there's 100 other people who were also doing it.
So its unstoppability was built into its design.
Absolutely.
Sure enough, several Usenet users offered to take over the hosting from the University of Waterloo, and Brad's page was up again right away. But the battle wasn't over. The Scottish Jewish joke's fate was about to be contested again, this time at Stanford University, where the verdict would arguably impact the lives of everyone who has ever used social media. To understand why, I need to first tell you about the Stanford campus in the 80s. It was a very progressive place. The small number of conservative students stood out, and some of them felt they were paying a price for standing out, like Eric Charles.
I came to Stanford from Oklahoma. I arrived on campus as a freshman. I still remember sitting at breakfast one morning, and there's two girls across the table from me talking, and one of them says, I don't understand why anybody would join the military.
Eric was a Marine. He was ROTC, which meant the Marines were paying for his tuition.
Now, I've got a shaved head. You know, I have a full-on Marine Corps legitimate haircut. And I just look up for my eggs and say, well, some of us don't have mummy and daddy to pay for it.
But then one day, Eric came home to find a flyer on his dorm room floor.
It was shoved underneath my door. And in there it said, are you a conservative who wants your voice heard? Call us and we're looking for more staffers for the paper. Someone was publishing a conservative newspaper.
So what did you do?
I walked over and I met the editor and said, I'd like to join. And he said, hi, I'm Peter. Shook his hand, said, great, what do you need me to do?
Straight away, Eric was bowled over by this enigmatic undergraduate called Peter.
He was smart. I mentioned Oklahoma. He's like, okay, was your family involved in the oil industry? Upstream, downstream? Like, all of a sudden, he's talking the language of that area. I mentioned ROTC. He's like, what branch? I mean, the ability to switch topics. It's just, I just remember him being extremely smart and driven.
Was he loud? Was he quiet?
Quiet. I would say cold and calculating, but I think that's a cruel statement. It makes him sound like a serial killer or something. Just kept that calm demeanor.
And so Eric and Peter threw themselves into lamenting political correctness in the pages of their new campus paper, the Stanford Review.
There had been this talk on campus about whether or not Beethoven had African ancestry. And there was one student who was adamant about it and two other students that thought it was ridiculous. There had been a flyer for an upcoming concert of Beethoven's music. And so they doctored up the flyer with every single black stereotype, an afro, lips. I don't know if they did the nose as well. And then put that flyer next to the door of the person in their dormitory who had been adamant that Beethoven was black.
Who was black themselves.
Yes, and that student was black themselves. And that was taken as hate speech. The two students were removed from housing.
The incident threw Stanford into a polarizing conflict. Students protested, calling for speech codes to prohibit racial obscenities from campus. That kind of activism wasn't so unusual for colleges in the 80s. More unusual was the backlash from conservative students like Eric and Peter.
The review said, hold it. So you can't make a flyer like that? That's sufficient to get thrown out of the dormitory? It's two people with one flyer. You could have ripped it up and thrown it away. Is this our new rule? Is this our new game? Do you believe in freedom of speech or not?
Yeah. And in the midst of this tense atmosphere, a Usenet user named June Jenis, who worked at Stanford University's computer centre, logged on to see what Brad Templeton's joke of the day was. It was the Scottish-Jewish one.
I thought it was funny, and then the whole brouhaha started about whether that kind of material should be on there.
June thought the ban at Brad's old university was ridiculous, and she said so in an off-the-cuff remark to her boss, John Sack.
Thinking that he would probably think it was a tempest in a teapot as well, but apparently he thought it was more serious than that and decided to take it to his superiors.
My name is John Sack, and I was the director of the Stanford Data Center.
John Sack has spent decades behind the scenes at Stanford, quietly concerned with the best ways of publishing scholarly journals online. But that day, it fell to him to figure out how Stanford should respond to the joke. Should they keep it up or ban it? Which, given that this was Stanford in the late 80s, put John at a pivotal moment in history.
Stanford was a pioneer in putting together what's usually referred to as town and gown, the idea that faculty could create companies that became centers of business excellence that really is the birth of Silicon Valley.
And the business ideas on campus were focused around one thing.
As you started to use computers in a social context, we were navigating the shoals of how much to allow the computer to do to and for people.
Brad's joke would be the perfect test case. The engineers, the architects of the emerging internet, were watching. This was John Sack's moment, his chance to steer the ship in one direction or another.
The course was not clear. Eventually, we were going to have to make a choice.
And so John and a colleague deliberated for several weeks before announcing that Brad's page would be banned from Stanford too. They explained their rationale in a detailed and heartfelt essay. In short, Stanford's, quote, love of freedom of expression mattered less than its collective search for a better way in which every person is acknowledged as an individual, not a caricature. But if John Sack hoped that his reasoning would sway the watching engineers, he had another thing coming. Instead, all hell broke loose in the form of a giant at Stanford, the late tenured professor John McCarthy. Here's John Sack's view of John McCarthy.
John is pretty widely credited with being one of the founders of the concept of artificial intelligence. He was probably one of the biggest names in computer science at the time. He was really an engineer, in the good and bad senses of that word.
What kind of man was he?
I am not going to answer that. Sorry. He was difficult for me to deal with.
Can you give me any kind of hint as to how his difficulty manifested?
He and I were in a meeting once, and he attacked my mother.
Why?
Because he wanted to insult me and basically say that I came from bad stock.
So he attacked you on a eugenics principle.
It's interesting that you raise that. There was a strain of that around campus. But I'm not saying John McCarthy was the eugenicist. And he, of course, never knew my mother. It was just a personal attack. And I just found that really hard to deal with.
John McCarthy was horrified at the thought of speech codes becoming the norm online. So he published a ferocious riposte to the ban, calling John Sack an underling who had spent those weeks not deliberating, but gurgling. He launched an online petition too, one of the very first in internet history, gathering 100 signatures from faculty. Then, as now, the power of the online petition was formidable. The ban on Brad's joke page was quickly reversed. John McCarthy's winning argument, John Sack says, had boiled down to...
We're really exploring the leading edge of computing here. Let's keep exploring it. Don't try and cut it off. We need to discover the boundaries of free speech by essentially running into them or crossing them.
And that's the internet we have all lived in for the decades that followed. a libertarian engineer's utopia where free speech thrived unencumbered, with no regard for the dangers it might cause society. And by dangers, I mean not only offensive speech, but fake news too. And because unencumbered free speech leads to conflict, which keeps people online longer than harmony does, it's a profitable ideology for the tech companies. It's epitomised best by how Twitter's UK general manager described the site in 2012 as the free speech wing of the free speech party.
The interesting thing about Twitter is it's sort of Silicon Valley native. So maybe it all does tie back to the libertarian bent in the engineering culture.
So how did our characters' lives turn out inside the world that John McCarthy had successfully advocated for? Brad's turned out very well.
For me, many positive things happened because of this kerfuffle. Rec.humor.funny became the most widely read thing on the internet for many, many years, and basically until Yahoo came around. It was safe to say this was the most widely read thing on the internet, which was obviously success for me.
Brad is now chairman of the respected civil liberties group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Before he died last year, Jonathan, who started the campaign to get the joke banned, set up a charity to help disadvantaged teenagers get into top universities. Eric, the Stanford Marine with the shaved head, is a software executive. And then there was Eric's fellow conservative at Stanford, the mysterious Peter.
Tell me, what did Peter do after he left college?
He went off to Wall Street, didn't even make it a year. Honestly, I lost track of him a little bit until he had started this little company. You may have heard of it. It's called PayPal.
So Peter was...
Peter Thiel.
Peter Thiel, who was also an early investor in Facebook and Airbnb and LinkedIn and Yelp and Spotify, and has for decades personified Silicon Valley's libertarian culture. Until 2018, when he abruptly left town, moving south to Los Angeles. When fellow libertarian Dave Rubin asked him why he left on his YouTube show, The Dave Rubin Report, Peter Thiel reflected on his time at Stanford.
Stanford was sort of a very liberal, politically correct place. The Silicon Valley surrounding, not so much. It was vaguely libertarian. And then sort of by the late 90s, I would say it had shifted to being sort of a moderate Democrat around the time I started PayPal. And if you fast forward another 20 years, it's sort of a pretty hard left.
And so maybe the Stanford progressives lost the battle, but are winning the war. That shift to the left helps explain what happened recently to the reporter, Louisa D'Amato, whose article had led to the original shaming campaign against Brad's joke. Louisa still works at the Kitchener Record, which covers the small town of Baden.
Last April, there were some White Lives Matter flyers distributed and the suggestion that there was going to be a march. I did a bit of investigating and found that these same flyers usually didn't materialize in a march, but were scattered around to see if anybody would show up. So I wrote that and I said, even though this seems very alarming, this probably is not what it looks like. In other words, we're not going to have hundreds of people marching for white supremacy in the streets of Baden.
But some readers saw Louisa's comments as underplaying the dangers of white supremacy.
So I was torn apart on Twitter and they called for a boycott of me. They demanded that I resign. They called me a racist.
And what did it feel like to be at the end of that?
It made me feel like I was about to cry all the time. I actually had to take time off work to manage the feelings of intimidation. And it made me frightened that I would be afraid to tackle these subjects again. And I would add that I turned out to be correct. There was no march. But when the march didn't materialize, I did not get an apology.
Did you also feel misrepresented by them?
Completely. They just said, she's a racist, she's a racist, she's a racist. And that was pretty much the debate.
You said that you were worried that the pylon would have a chilling effect on you writing similar articles in the future. And I think that's probably what Brad Templeton would say too. He was worried about the chilling effect.
Yes, exactly. It never occurred to me at the time that what happened to him was like what happened to me. But actually, in some ways, perhaps it was. A true free speech advocate doesn't differentiate between junky speech like insensitive jokes and thoughtful arguments that are meant to help us understand the world that we live in.
When John Sack, the man who tried to get Brad's jokes banned from Stanford, thought back on that time, I could tell it wasn't losing that he was upset about. He was frustrated with himself for being trapped within his own binary thinking. Ban the site or keep it up.
What were the sort of middle way, third way options?
I can't remember one. I can't remember one that we seriously debated.
Some kind of compromise that would have encouraged people to be more civil.
Oh, that would have been wonderful. If we had something like that, wouldn't Twitter and Facebook want to use it too?
And from that day on, the internet would, in its peculiarly terrible way, influence the ferocity with which every culture war would subsequently be fought. Next time, how the unique experiences of a little girl growing up unconventionally in America in the 70s seismically changed the face of feminism in the 90s and beyond. Things Fell Apart was presented by me, John Ronson, and produced by Sarah Shebbier. The assistant producer was Sam Peach. The music was composed by Phil Channel. The programme was mixed by Bob Nettles. The editor was Philip Sellers. It's a BBC audio production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.